Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Sprint Podcast. This week we're covering the 2001 Rally Finland, the 9th round of that season, 2001 season that we're focusing on for this first series of the Sprint Podcast. And once again, I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in today and all your comments and feedback and for kind of giving us the encouragement to keep going. Although we'll be doing it anyway, but it's just great to see so many people are enjoying it and we're not alone in our passion for this era of the sport. So we have a full house this week. We have Tommy's back with us as usual.
Hi, how's it going, guys?
We've William.
Can I get an as usual at some stage? I'd love to graduate that.
Turn up regularly and you will.
I've had three in a row.
Yeah,
you're not getting a match ball yet.
No. And we've super sub Art McCarrick in once again this week. Joining
Art Solskjaer.
Greetings.
Yeah. So I suppose again it's been another unusual week to say the least, around the globe. Just purely from a motorsport point of view. A few more cancellations coming through. The Safari was pulled, no real surprises there. And there's been a lot of debate kind of regarding the viability of the championship as a whole this year. Now, there was talk that they'd need 7 rounds at a minimum for it to count, but it's kind of up in the air at the moment. Nobody knows, you know, what can run, and if so, when. So, and something we've kind of discussed over the last few episodes, obviously it's at the forefront of our minds. But again, just another kind of nail in the coffin for this season, obviously. You know, we all know the reasons why, but just it just makes you think. So hopefully the Safari will get going again next year, as we saw in last week's episode. A fantastic event. And like you listening to the Dwarfish podcast there, some of the tales from Derek Donsey and George Johnson, that they were amazing. Like they were, you know, it was just a totally different adventure to anything else that was on around at the time, bar maybe some of the kind of rallies like the Hong Kong Beijing and stuff like that, but just a great event, and we'd love to see it back again.
Yeah, it's probably, I suppose, the only thing that's kind of a step ahead of it really are the likes of the rally raids, things like Dakar. And I suppose another bit of news to come from the week, you know, on the team at Dakar, great to see Carlos Sainz probably on the back of his Dakar win getting the Ferrari drive. Not that, no.
Yeah.
Different shirt, Tom. Completely different shirt.
But the thing about it is that I'm just doing that to reiterate that there is only one Carlos Sainz. He's Carlos Sainz Jr. They need to, you know, they have to, you know, let's just get things in order and, you know, know your place.
Yeah, the young fella didn't lick it off a stone anyway, that's for sure.
No, he didn't.
You know what I like about that is not only is he lucky enough to have the name Carlos Sainz, but just Carlos Sainz Jr. as a character just seems like a pretty cool lad as well. So, like, I'm delighted for him to get the drive.
You mean like James Bond Jr.?
But as well, let alone the material is providing every one of us for really crap memes using his second name. Carlos actually signs, Carlos Sainz signs. There's endless possibilities.
Hey, do you just get my fucking joke?
Yeah, absolutely. In your face.
Sorry, I have no story now.
Edit that out.
Oh, man.
NASCAR's back.
NASCAR is back. Yeehaw.
Any word on our friend Kyle Larson? Remember him and his outburst on
calling him a friend now wouldn't be wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I don't think he's back. But anyway, yeah, as I said, he's back in some capacity anyway. I'm not sure how it's working out from over there, but I'm kind of looking at anything that's happening in the States at the moment with just horror at the situation over there. So I wouldn't exactly be taking kind of encouragement from them getting anything back going. In fact, they're almost displaying how not to do things in every sense of their response. So I think
they're living the American dream, Maris.
Yeah.
No, but you're right in what you're saying, that it's taken too much of a narrow view to try and, you know, say, like, look at it. Yay, motorsports is back. The bigger picture here, really, motorsports are only a drop in the ocean. And, like, granted, we miss it. I miss getting up at 6:30 a.m. to drive to sign on somewhere, you know, and urinate in ditches for most of my Saturday afternoon while writing notes, while breaking the top of a pencil down a bumpy road, you know. But
driving the wrong way up a bumpy road.
No, that wasn't me.
It was. I was not.
We're not going to do this again.
No. He needs to own up.
But the reality of it is, like, it's a sickener that we're missing it, but, like, what else can we do?
Just taking
on the chain, like, you know what I mean? That's it.
Yeah, you'd miss the feeling of park for me in the morning. You just walk in and it's cold and everything is just warming up. The smell of fuel's in the air. There's cars idling everywhere. The first few crews are starting to leave the control or whatever.
And there's something about the reaction, isn't there, between the cold air. It's something unreal.
Oh, man.
Some of my favourites are, like, Park Firm in West Cork, down the model railway village car park, and Killarney, at Rally the Lakes in the middle of Killarney. There is just, I remember the last time I was actually in Killarney doing the event, was the Historics a couple of years ago, and they're like half five, six in the morning. It's still dark. You know, all the historic cars starting up and it's freezing cold. There's nothing beats that.
Yeah, that gives me that, just I'm getting the jitters just nearly thinking about it. Like, there's that kind of that period in the morning between Park Forme and, I suppose, up until the start line of the first stage, really. That's you're definitely.
I love the bit where you go to driver's briefing, and driver's briefing might necessarily be all that near Park Forme, and you probably just pile into a car with about $4 or $5. Boots and helmets and everything, and she might know half of them. Like,
it's not social distancing anyway.
No, we'll have to look at that for when Riley gets back on his arts mitted or arts transport from
even on that point, like, that's something down at a club level. But I remember even seeing that at Rally Spain in 2010 off the finish ramp. And I remember, do you know where the finish ramp is down there in front of the beach? And we come off and we're watching what was going on, and all of a sudden you had, I think you had Carla Cassini, Henning Solberg, Cato Merkerud, and two others piling into the back of a Peugeot 307. There's about four or five, literally just, and no offence to Henning Solberg, but you don't want him laying and crashed in the back seat of a car. And the lads tearing up to the hotel across the loo. I just thought, Joe, to see that at world level and club level, it's what makes sport so good as well. There's no real division between the two.
It's like I was watching a music DVD there lately, but it was New Order, and they were talking about, if you don't feel the butterflies before you go on stage to play a gig, you know, like, there's something not right. And it's like, no matter how experienced you are, no matter how many events you've done during the year, you always have just that little, it's a nervous energy, it's excitement, really. And so, but, like, you've hit the nail on the head there with about the lakes, the historic lakes in Killarney, just gone in December. That was, for me, that was one of the best feelings in ages, like you described perfectly, going in pitch black after, you know, in to do your belts and get the time card ready for, you know, your time out. And just the darkness. You, like, nobody should be up at that hour of the morning in December. Nobody.
Let alone,
the risk of sounding cheesy, that kind of, there's almost a bit of an air of mystery. You're like, Jesus, what will happen today? This is going to be brilliant.
Yeah,
you know, everyone else is warm in bed and we're mad ages, they're up freezing our asses.
The Ulster rally is a killer for that too. The Sunday of the Ulster always had a really early start, like 6 in the morning or something ridiculous.
That's proper rally. That's
a horrible, horrible rally.
They had a minimum, but, like, it was always something like the first cars were in at 11 o'clock or something at night. But, like, with the 1 minute interval, if there was 100 cars in the rally, you might not be in till half 12. And you're back out at 5 in the morning again, you know.
The year I did it, and that wasn't that long ago, it was roughly the same. I think by the time we got back, and there was delays with the night stage and everything, by the time we got back to Derry, it was like 1 o'clock, and I was only staying a 2 minute walk from where service and Park Farm was, and back down the next morning, then at 6 or something, and, like, the top cars had already gone at 5:30. It was mad.
Yeah,
that's good,
that's just part of it, really. Like, isn't it? It's a bit of a throwback, I suppose, to the older days. I remember Ypres. I'm not sure what it's like nowadays, but definitely, you know, in the heyday, the Group A era, and probably a few years before that, the timing was like mental tight. Like you wouldn't even have time to take off the helmet and the road sections or get them strapped right and all that. You know, it was just crazy. And you know, that kind of constant buzz over the weekend, there was no lull. I remember doing the Cork Forestry, was it? I think. Yeah, it is. The one in Ballyvourney a few years ago. And there was like an hour at each service, like, and two stages back then, hanging around for an hour. Should the boys at the car fucking checked in 10 minutes? You know what I mean? There was, you know, just all this kind of, you were almost kind of trying to build back up to it again on every road section. No, Cork Forestry is a fantastic rally. Don't get me wrong, the stages are some of the best forestry stages in the country. Like, but you know, you're gonna, when you have that sort of frantic, sort of, you know, tight road sections and the buzz is there the whole day, the road sections are,
keeps you on your toes.
Exactly. Yeah.
I would have loved, and like in late 90s, early 2000s, Jim Clark, like starting at 8 in the evening and finishing at 7 the next morning, all through the night.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that would be.
You beat me to it.
Yeah.
You beat me to it.
Would have loved to have done that.
Thank you. Like, what I would love to see, but it's not going to happen because, look, I think there's far too many regulations and, you know, health and safety things in place. But a rally, for example, in Ireland, there's no reason why you can't have three stages on the Friday night and have an early finish on the Sunday. You know, over a weekend. Now, technically, it makes it a 3-day rally, but like, I think there will be something to be said for, you know, going out and doing three stages in the evening time. You know, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah, and there probably is a bit of an appetite for that. I know, like, the practicalities behind it have changed in the last few years. You have to ask the Rallies Commission. I think I must check exactly. I don't have the rule book beside me, but I think it's something like 4 months in advance. That you have permission to run one, let alone multiple, but let's say you did want to run two or three. Mm. All the stage signage, then the arrows and whatnot, have to be reflective. So it makes it prohibitive to use a stage that you've already used earlier in the day, because you'd have to redo the signage. You have to have a certain amount of auxiliary lighting at some junctions. And I think the last few times night stages I've run, the last time I did a night stage, in this jurisdiction anyway, it was West Cork 2017. They ran Sam's Cross last thing on the Saturday, but they had to hand out torches and high-vis vests to the crews at the arrival control. No, there was no batteries in the torches, but
the sentiment was there.
It was the thought that counts.
In saying that, Art, on the night stage, I remember the last night stage again was the Killarney Historics, where they ran Gartnagan twice and in the evening. So it would have, yeah, it was kind of 6-7 o'clock. So it was,
yeah, and Killarney always get really. There's been a couple of situations where they've thought they could get away without running a night stage, and it happened there 2 years ago. The historic cars got through, but then all the modified cars got a nominal time because it wasn't safe for them to run, and they hadn't the necessary permission and signage and all the rest of it for it to actually be a night stage.
We had such a sketchy experience that year. Was that 2018?
Yeah.
We actually didn't make the start line of the last stage. We were tired and the stage before that. The gasket went. And we were, I'd say to this day, the scariest thing I've ever experienced in a rally car, right? We managed to find someone. We put up at a junction anyway. And we were trying to figure out how we get back to Killarney, how we get the boys out to us with the trailer or whatever. So we said, we were at the junction and a spectator offered to tow us back as far as Farn 4. He'd, I think it was a brand new Land Cruiser even, right? So he said, grand, we're not staying here for the evening. So in fairness, he got us out and down the road, and I'd say we were about 200 yards down the road, and I just turned to Aidan, the guy I was going driving for, and I said to him, Jesus Christ, man, this fella's Aidan road, like, and the fucking chain was barely fucking, you couldn't even see in front of where we were going. We were just relying purely on what your man was doing. I'm not joking, I reckon the quickest we went all weekend was behind that fucking Jeep. It was terrifying. Down Boreen's, man, I honestly checked the snapshot on the phone during the fucking GPS or whatever, like, and we were doing like not far off 90 miles an hour one set. It was nuts. And I put the belts on, tighten them as much as I could. I was actually looking around for the helmet to see could it. I was genuinely like, I was like, this is dodgy. Like, we're going to get in trouble here, but we made it out anyway. So,
it's some buzz doing a night stage, like, because you don't. It's a completely different skill, and it's I suppose it's kind of a shame it's gone, because like when you turn on the full pod, and you'll obviously have made your notes in the daylight. So you might have like, you know, small crest, 100, whatever. When you're coming up to that small crest in the dark with lamp pods on, like the far side of that small crest may as well be like a cliff edge. You just can't see anything beyond it. Any little dip in the road is just...
It seems to amplify the size of the bumps of the crest like tenfold, doesn't it?
Like I said, with my experience, I was looking up, it was in a left-hand drive quattro. So not only was it on night stage, I was on the wrong side of the car, reading notes and looking up, and I was like, this. No, it was unbelievable, because I remember coming to the first hairpin in Gartnagan, it felt proper old school. There's a massive crowd of people, a lot of lights, and you come into a junction and the sound of a quattro coming out of it. I remember sitting to myself kind of smiling, going, Jesus, this is just brilliant. But then, like, trying to concentrate when everything is just wrong, but it's, I'd still do it again.
My lasting experience of a night stage is probably the last time I've done one was very lucky. Went to Spain to do a rally classical in Mallorca. It's a rally in Mallorca, and the first loop stages were all on the night time on the thing was the Thursday night. But it's that one thing of you're driving out to the stage and you've written your notes, everything's fine, everything's good, we're going the right way, we're plenty of time. And looking at the map light, I was like, yeah, that's working fine, that's good. You're just thinking, right, everything's working perfectly. Nothing can go wrong. I look at the map light again. I just check it a second time. Map light stops working. So you end up having to go into Bear Grylls mode. Do you remember the Livestrong wristbands that everyone had? Them? Sorry?
Did they have like a reflective or something, were they?
No, but I couldn't. I was there. I was like, geez, the last thing he wants to do is put off the driver here. Now, he's after flying out his BDA escort all the way out to this place, and the last thing he wants to think about now is, oh, with no lights through the north. So what I did was I got the mobile phone, turned the lamp on, pushed it underneath the Livestrong band, which basically held it in place to point it away from him down towards the north. There was something about just night driving, it's just, with call notes, it's just unbelievable when you come to a junction and you should be put off by the fact that there's all these flashes going off as well from the cameras and things at the different junctions. Like you see it on the likes of Monte Carlo back in the day, you'd see the in-car cameras when they come up to the air, and it just lights up the inside of the car. And it's like you said about the morning time inside in Parker, night time in, you know, that kind of early time of the year, not quite summer, not quite the end of spring either. And it just amplifies the smells, it amplifies everything. It's cool, but not freezing. Just bring back night rallying.
Yeah, you're right, Tom.
I don't know, I'm lamenting something that I only got to eat.
Let's all go do the first rally that runs back over here.
I'm going checking rallies in Sweden, because they obviously have the narrowest amount of light at certain times here.
I'll go do
a rally out there. Yeah, we're into a Group N Astra or something.
That's the other thing. There's only a small enough percentage of rallies that you can actually run. Like, it's only anything up until the end of March, and then from September on, there isn't all that many rallies in that window that can do it. So, yeah.
But even the evening kind of thing would be nice too, you know, just to give something, just an aspect to it.
It's just, you look at the likes of the sunset rally there up the north, that just kind of faded away because boys didn't want to do it or didn't have a carbon lamp pod that was way too much. You know, it's kind of gone a bit too much one way, but maybe this is a bit of an old control alt delete, but we might get back to some of that stuff in those.
Yeah.
Morris, are you able to kind of overdub some kind of nostalgic, melancholic music for our real lamenting of, you know, the lack of nights?
As you offer the Strings or something.
We're heading for a copyright strike, I'm sure, with the team, with the intro anyway, so sure, we might as well fucking finish it off there. But...
he's only loving the exposure, go away.
But anyway, we can't wait to get back out, Jesus, even to spectate. Just the last motorsporty thing I was at was drifting in Mandela in, I think, the end of January, start of February. And I still, you know, drift. I like drifting, but it's not my, you know, main passion or whatever in terms of motorsport. It's obviously rallying is number one. But still, it was class to, so I'm even thinking that day was great crack. I got it, sat in with a couple of friends, and, you know, even just the smell and the noise and everything, like, that's just, you'd be amazed how much you miss it when it's not there, you know what I mean? And I'll hold my hands up and say, like, I was very kind of bad for going to rallies the last couple of years. Can probably count on one hand the amount of rallies I was attending each year at this stage. Just various other things going on or whatever, like, but still had a passion for it. But, you know, I tell you what, whenever the first event runs and it's safe to do so, guarantee we'll all be there. It doesn't matter where in the country it's at, we'll be at it.
You'll have a packed event. I think that'll be the best thing about the first proper rally back. You'll have a bumper entry list, hopefully.
Hopefully.
He's got people in a position to do it, but spectating always, I think, would be fantastic.
I think it might even be a while from that. Like, you'll probably have a full entry of an event running in some capacity before we have spectators back.
Because you just
can't legislate for them. Like, you know, you look at, okay, football has started now. You know, how long is it going to be behind closed doors? Like, so.
Yeah. Look, when it's safe to do so, like, we want.
That's it.
But I suppose, like ourselves, kind of doing a lot of the podcast and things like that with the kind of spare time we have, I suppose there's a lot of people that are digging into their own archives during this period, because obviously there's nothing new to film, so, you know, but it's amazing what's coming out of the woodwork, you know, both from just amateurs and fans and stuff like that, as well as the recognized kind of our professional kind of crews, and, like, you know, RPM, which is obviously one of the most important, I suppose, factors for our kind of passion for the sport all the way up along, and I'm sure a lot more people besides us. I know MI have acquired the archive there, so Archie probably know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, bought it. Obviously, it came up for sale, I think, maybe around this time last year, and it was bought, I suppose, with the intention of making sure that it didn't go to some kind of collector or someone who would buy it for themselves. Now, however unlikely that would have been, to kind of protect the provenance of it and the importance of it. And the plan was, over time, I suppose, to digitize it, and with everything that goes on. And of course, we have a very small staff and all the rest. It's really, when were we going to get to do it? And what has happened over the last month or so has kind of allowed us to look at that and how we would do it. So, Sen and O'Connor, actually, of Vantage Point Video, does a lot of the hill climbs, puts up some old rally footage from himself from back in the day. He's doing the digitizing of the footage, because the sale also included all the equipment to play it on, because it's all in various different formats. Some of it is pre-RPM. So it's the RPM archive, which was from 91 up to, I think, 2014 or something. But there's also footage going back into the mid-80s, before RPM existed, when it was Tyndall Productions or Video Active, or various different things. So, there's no real structure on how it has been uploaded, only that something is being uploaded each Thursday. The reason for, I suppose, Thursday is obviously the day that RPM used to be on, so it's kind of a nod to that. But the boxes that it has come in, it was filed presumably by alphabetically or chronologically, one or the other, in Alan Tyndall's place. But when it was put into boxes, the same order wasn't put on it.
So it's basically the order of stuff that Sennin is taking it out. But I think the rough plan really is, okay, whatever's in the box is probably going to be twice as many rallies as every other discipline. So a rally every second week and some other bit of either circuit racing or a kart race or a retro trial or a hill climb. They used to cover those pretty extensively in the early to mid-90s on the weeks in between. So I suppose for listeners listening, it was 1984 Donegal from last week. I think this week's one is Saloons from Mondello in 1992. So probably be full of Sierra Cosworths. And the week after that, just don't know. We're kind of doing it on a week-to-week basis at the minute. So
no, it's brilliant. It's fantastic that the archive has gone into the hands of you know, a body or people that will actually share it with the wider public. As you said, you know, it'd be an awful shame if it did go into the hands of a collector and was just stored away and no one was allowed to see it or whatever. So no, it's and if you look at, you know, what the YouTube channel VHS Rallies are doing as well,
yeah,
fantastic. It's the same kind of idea.
There is an appetite for that stuff all the time, but I suppose even more so in the last couple of months. And what I suppose what I'm looking forward to the most is the odd rallies they used to cover. Like, you know, they might cover the Stone Throwers, just like they might cover like two Stone Throwers in like 20 years, but you know, they did odd national events and stuff.
Yeah, do you remember when they went to Ypres? 96,
yeah. Yeah, they went to Ypres with Liam O'Callaghan.
Oh, that was unbelievable. That was like, I remember watching that, and that was my probably first proper exposure to European rallying.
Yeah,
you know, that was, as I said, I was probably, what, 5 or 6
and years I think old. They did the Tour of Flanders the year before with O'Callaghan as well.
They did, in 185, exactly, yeah. But I remember just being blown away by, I think Amir Schwartz was first on the road in the quasi-walks car or whatever, like, and it was just such a level.
League.
Oh, it was just insane. You know, and obviously would have been fascinated with what was happening in Irish rallying at the time, and, you know, the likes of Fisher and McHale and Nesbitt and the battles they were having, but This just seemed like a totally, like, it almost seemed more exotic than the World Championship, even for some reason. Yeah. I don't know why, yeah. But and it was brilliant to see. So a lot of fair play. The club is an absolute.
But part of me would have loved if everything was going up chronologically, because you know what was coming next, or you could.
Yeah.
There's something nice about that too, though, because the
complete randomness of it is good, and again, like. Yeah, obviously, if it was just rally videos, your views would be through the roof. But the footage is of lots of disciplines, and we're a governing body that has 11 disciplines under our umbrella. So
it's cool to see every aspect of it. Yeah, yeah. No, it's great to see it.
Art, just a question on the footage. What's the plan for sharing and releasing? Is there kind of a scheduler, or what do you guys?
Every Thursday at 7 o'clock, there's an upload for the minute.
Did you just go to sleep, William, or what?
It goes up everywhere. Similarly, so it goes live on the YouTube channel, the Motorsport Ireland YouTube channel at 7 o'clock. It's premiered on the Facebook page at that time. It's on Instagram TV as well. And, so 7 o'clock on a Thursday, and then you can watch it back then after that. And like, at the minute, with the amount of programs that's there, which is nearly 400 and something programs, I think, of varying different lengths. Like, if you're only doing one a week, it could take you 7 or 8 years.
Years and that, like, yeah.
I presume we might be in a position once things become a little bit clearer and stable that we might be able to do, you know, two a week, or, you know, it's something a little bit more once the channel builds up a bit of. Bit of momentum, you know.
But it's fantastic as well to see the other disciplines, because I think I hope I'm not just speaking for myself. RPM, the fact that it covers, you know, circuit racing at Mondello and other disciplines, they'd often have things like the Vauxhall Lotus Euro Series, and you'd see Irish racers going abroad to, you know, race in Formula 4, things like that. Like, it did give us a broader taste of motorsport, not purely a rallying. And I think a lot of people got a love for motorsport in a broader nature from it, you know, as well.
Yeah,
and I'm fairly sure there's going to be some good rallycross stuff from the mid '90s too, and stuff like that in there. So like big boost power stuff. So there's full catalogs with every program of like start lists and results and stuff. So that's the next thing now. When I get all the results from each of the events, send those to EWRC for them to update their event databases. So there's event results from pretty much every event in the archive as well.
That's unreal.
The question that the three of us really want to know though is the soundtracks that they use. Please say they're kept in it as
they are. And see, I don't know. Maybe we might snag something down the line there where you do upload, because the easiest thing for us to do is upload the final produced program that they had, which would have the bits of music in it. So hopefully you don't run into too many copyright things.
What would be great, because on Tommy's point there, because I know we've spent a lot of time kind of talking and sharing old songs that from different pieces of footage that sometimes you might know the name or the band or whoever produced it. But I think if you could extrapolate the soundtrack out of it and create just one big soundtrack of RBM.
I literally have a Spotify playlist with just like RPM tunes and motorsport sort of stuff. And it, I'll
share. Is that your Battle Axe playlist, Mars?
It is. Yeah. So
I actually only downloaded a song the other day with a motorsport team on it. Curtis, what the hell is his name? It mightn't be Curtis. It used to be on International Motorsport, something like that. It was on ITV. And there was like a guitar.
Oh, yeah. It used to be on about 3 in the morning or something.
Yeah, and Nick Heidfeld was racing in F3 in it. That's the only thing I remember is Nick Heidfeld in that before he got to F1. But it's like Curtis Schwantz or something like that. But I downloaded that the other day. I typed it into YouTube and I eventually got it on Spotify.
Fire that on. I found the majority of stuff is on Spotify, which is great.
It's unreal.
Spotify is not great if you're an artist, of course, unless you're multi-million streams. It's a very good library. You know, we can pretty much access any sound that's ever been made. So
this, the only other thing that we, as well as the programs, it's also, so if you were Johnny Clubman running down the road, there was probably 15 or 16 shots of you over a 2 or 3 day rally from 6 or 7 different cameras.
See, these are all the originals.
All those tapes are there too. So in an ideal world, like somewhere down the line, you would love to digitize everything, each car number, have the name, and people could like request them or build their own compilations or something, but that's a long way away yet. But all that is in it too.
Just get Plum to move in with you, will you? Just make it happen.
The thing is, it is effectively a full-time job for someone. And there was an ad back in, I was looking back through an old Car Sport magazine, and back in the late 80s, early 90s, RPM themselves were offering that service. You could buy a compilation tape of the footage of you that was captured on an event that wouldn't have been aired. So if they could do it back then, I'm sure it could be done now, but that's a whole other level of digitizing. And
there's some more to work on that,
mental. But we probably just need to be on a bit more of a sure footing before that goes in.
Yeah.
Imagine if you can get to that place.
Speak for myself anyway, I'm sure, as I said, for many other people, RPM and the rest of Plum's productions were absolutely pivotal in, you know, my formative years in getting interested in the sport and stuff. And there was probably a period there, especially during the kind of the WRC career, you know, I look forward to RPM more than I look forward to the WRC coverage in the mid-2000s, to be honest. It had everything. Like, it had the music, as you said. Like, my musical taste was probably influenced in a fair fashion by what was being played in RPM. They nailed that side of it as well, which is like such an important thing. And it's only kind of obvious when a program doesn't get it right. You know?
There was a marked change in the music. There was a marked change in the music from about 98 kind of onwards. It kind of got current, I suppose, are a bit more alternative. And there was none of the diddly idle stuff anymore. And from kind of 98 on, the music side of things rocketed
on. Yeah, like,
didn't you go on? Go on, sorry. On that point, like, you're talking about looking forward to it more than the WRC coverage. Like, I know even from my point of view, when I was younger, before I was even allowed to start going to rallies, like, it got you so much closer to it because the programs were produced so well. And they were so in depth, and it was the step down, Joe. Like, when you watch World Championship coverage, it's very, very glossed. It's very, very heavily packaged into a nice kind of media spin. But RPM was just proper direct coverage, getting in depth. You felt a lot more connected to it when you couldn't go to events. You know what I mean?
It made stars out of the drivers. I mean, like, we're living in an age now where probably accessibility in terms of Twitter and Facebook, that you're probably friends with the drivers you watch now on TV at the rallies, you know, or friends is a very loose term now, because, you know, you could have 1,200 friends on Facebook and know maybe 200 of them. But back in them days, like, Plum made them, the fact that it was on TV in a nation that only had two channels, it lent us kind of certain exoticness to rallying. It made it very attractive as a sport, you know.
Yeah, I know you're spot on there. Like, as I said, there's almost overexposure, I suppose, to content now. You could nearly argue that, you know, especially if you're friends, as you say, with kind of rallying folk on social media, or you follow them, you know, the weekend of a rally, it can just be a glut of results, photos, videos, on the pace note, whatever. And, you know, there's such a thing as too much of it as well. I find, anyway, like, I just sometimes can't look at it. I just don't go near it.
Yeah, I'd agree, Mars. Let's say, for example, if you take just Twitter alone as a platform, you go on there and you go into your automatic kind of jumping up to the most current news after a weekend of maybe one World Championship event or two European events, or there's just an endless stream of content.
Yeah.
There's no filtering process. There's no value content. There's just everyone is doing the same thing.
But yeah, there's people that would argue that, you know, oh, we don't need television, we have the internet. And I think when you look at something with the production quality of what Tyndall Productions used to create with RPM, it does show the value in the finished product of a really well-made television program. Like, you could watch sketch shows or clips of something on the internet, right, for maybe 2 seconds, or sorry, 2 minutes a piece, or, you know, a 2 minute clip of a rally. When you see a video, or if something comes on television, it's going to be a 40 minute review where there's a story, a start, a middle, and the end with an introduction with, yeah, you know, very well produced.
But like, and that's where the cost is in anything, is in production. And the perfect example is now we've bought that archive and it's all on tapes, and we're digitizing it because that's how people are consuming, how they're consuming it now. You know, we're not sending it back to RTE for them to put it back on telly. That's not going to happen. So, but you look at the still production qualities to be had in motorsport and telling the story. If you just love it, like the Drive to Survive thing on Netflix or whatever. Now, I don't know what the fuck they're going to do it this year, but
Drive to Stay at Home.
Yeah, but
Carlos Sainz going to the supermarket again.
In a non-professional sport, so we'll take rallying in this country as an example of that, or motorsport in this country in general, the online content is still viewed as, you know, free, and get it out there and get everyone to consume it, and more people are seeing this than it's on telly, without ever once passing any heed of the production values of the thing, or how it will age, or how people look back on
that. Yeah, it's a big thing.
10 years. Hang
on. Wasn't there a guy
this
there?
This might bring that into focus.
Wasn't there a guy there a couple of years ago with the Talmadge Championship? He had some good ideas. Whatever happened to him?
Careful, Morris.
Morris, develop this point. I'd love to hear this.
No, sorry. The cat is actually at the door. Hang on. His name is Stephen.
Do you remember those really bad Finnish songs we were talking about last week as well?
Yeah.
And then there was efforts. Let's not go there. No.
Anyway, the cat's name is Stephen. I thought about calling him Ari Kattinen, but I was shot down.
I've Yari Matti Katvala at home.
Nice. Nice.
Yanni Paasonen.
Oh, wow. That's a really
taking it right up to 2001.
Yeah. We'll get to Finland just in just a sec. I just want to give just a shout out there as well to Trevor Agnew again. He started his own podcast under the Stage by Stage brand that he runs. And the first one was very interesting. He got
super listening.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Rory Kennedy and Gordon Noble on, and some great stories and some very good insight and I suppose advice to people. So if you haven't already checked it out, give it a listen. We'll, as we mentioned previously, we'll be getting Trevor and Neil Wearden on to talk to us very soon. So we'll keep you posted as to when that's coming up. But looking forward to getting those guys on to share their stories of 2001 and other aspects of their career, so that'll be great. So we'll move on to Finland. We're sponsored this week by Karjala beer. I've never actually drank it. Looking forward to getting an old sip, but now is it good? I've read varying accounts of what it's like. It's some people say it's great, other people say it's fucking shite. But
if you're drinking a warm can in the middle of a forest in the summer watching rally cars, do you care?
I've had it. It's okay, but it's nowhere near the best drink in Finland. There's a drink you can get in Finland. I bought it in the airport by mistake in Helsinki when I got there. It's called Original Long Drink, and it's probably somewhere between gin and tonic and a Smirnoff Ice. But it's in a can, and it comes in various different flavors. And then there's a strong version of it, which is in a black can, and that's 7.5%, and it's the nicest of them all, dangerously enough. but it's just unreal, and they serve it on tap in places, and you can buy it in shops, and how it hasn't taken over the world. My God, the minute it gets sold here, we're all done for. I looked at getting a case of it. I brought a few back with me, all right, but to get a case of it was prohibitively expensive to get delivered, but I might splash out now to celebrate the end of lockdown or something. But that's Original Long Drink, original and the gin, the original word, the G-I-N is capitalized, so just emphasizes like this.
I see what they did there.
Very good.
But it's a very, very unassuming drink. Jeez, it'll blow the head off you. It's unreal. But it's no Karjala. They're footing the bill. Fair play to them.
Yeah.
Yanni Paasonen's letting us stay at his lake house anyway, so we'll be in the sauna after this.
Getting Marco Allen in on it too, the two of them in the team for the weekend.
Williams got sticks, so we can bait ourselves over the back anyway, so we'll be all right.
That's the job. We look forward to, hopefully we get there next year. We kind of hummed and hawed about going this year, not going to obviously work out for obvious reasons, even if it does run, which is looking a little bit unlikely, but kind of had the opportunity to go a couple of times before and just didn't work out. So we'll definitely be getting going as soon as we can once this COVID thing blows over, because from anyone I've talked to that's been there, it's just the most incredible experience.
Blow your mind.
Yeah, especially with these current cars, I really would love to get this to see the cars in Finland, but hopefully it'll work out. Obviously another, you know, real classic event. It seems like the calendar back then was just classic after classic. Change.
Filler.
No, it was just brilliant. There was even nice. The rallies you think might have been less of an event than others, they still proved to be just brilliant.
Yeah, like Cyprus was filler and it was good.
It was, yeah. Surprisingly.
But like when you look at it, like not wanting to speak out of turn on how some of the events are chosen for it now, but it seems to be whoever brings the biggest purse of money and, you know, the tourist board pays for it. If you look then, there was rallies that had heritage. There was a history to each and every rally, with the exception, we could say, of Cyprus. But Cyprus was there from the year before because of a lack of the China rally. You know, like these were all rallies that had a history in the sport that, you know, it meant something to be there, you know what I mean? Because of those that had gone before and had success there, you know.
Yeah.
And Finland is obviously the pinnacle
It was you know, it's a fairly big contrast to the last few events in terms of surface. Obviously, Finland is well known for the jumps. Really kind of smooth, compacted gravel. The stages, they don't really cut up a lot. Like, it's smooth to the point where on quick sections you could actually hear tire roar like you would on tarmac with a slick. You know, that's how smooth some parts of it are. Some narrow sections on various stages as well. I think they were bringing them in at various points to try and keep the average speeds down, but invariably they were up towards the upper tolerance of the FIA as a lowered average speed for an event.
But even on the stages, Morris, with that, like, Joey, have your traditional kind of fairly wide, smooth, compact gravel. Like, with some of those less famous stages, if you watch some onboards, especially on second runs or that kind of thing, they can get quite rough and rutted and narrow in Finland. If you don't, even on Unemployed, there's some sections where it wouldn't look typically Finland, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, definitely. As I said, the smaller roads. I remember seeing an onboard of McRae, and the yoke is kind of happening on the ruts in some corners as well. But in general, just was overall, it was, you know, compared to the rallies that had preceded it, it was almost like a pool table in terms of surface. Obviously, at this point, it had been pretty much dominated by the Scandinavians throughout its history. There was only two instances of a non-Scandinavian driver winning. That was Sainz in 1990, was it? Or 91, yeah. And Ariel in 92. Both drivers that were still competing at the top level in you know, top cars at this point. So, but, you know, the farm guy, I suppose, going into it and looking at previous years and the way the championship was going 2001 was Mäkinen. Mäkinen's home place, as far as I know, is only up the road from Jyväskylä, which is the base for the event. So and he'd won numerous years. Previously, Granholm beat him in 2000, and Kankinen won 1999. But Tommy had a very good run throughout the 90s. He actually scored his first WRC win in Finland in 1994. So he was definitely fancied, and you know, the test had gone well leading up to it, and he was just on a high as well after winning the Safari. So yeah, you know, it looked pretty ominous actually going into it for some of the other guys in the championship. Mäkinen had a 10-point lead over McRae, and he had the reputation for being very quick at home, and had the car was working well for him and stuff at this point. I'd say the other drivers were getting a little bit worried. Going into it, Granholm, as you said as well, he'd won the previous year, couldn't be discounted as well. And you know, the Peugeot obviously had the pace. It was just the question marks are still going to be there in terms of reliability for the car.
It was a fairly bumper entry in the rally as well. Made up 21 stages and 406 kilometers. There was 160 entries. Nearly over 25% of the entry were A8 cars. World Rally cars and Group A cars. 18 of them were works cars, with extra works cars entered by some of the teams. Skoda entered a car for Stig Blomqvist in an interesting move. Juha Kankinen was entered in a third car for Hyundai, and Tony Gardemeister was in a third Mitsubishi Lancer for Mitsubishi Rally Art team. Their privateers, there was, like we said, huge entry of World Rally Car and Latter Day Group A cars. Gilles Panizzi was in a Grafoni 206. You were probably in a kind of a golden period as well for Finnish drivers, even domestically, that had done the BRC and gone to done championships around Europe. We had Janne Tuohino, Jussi Pikkalisto. Marco Ellen actually turned up to do the rally in a Ford Focus. Yeah. And we also seen Juha Kangas. Now, Juha Kangas is an interesting driver, just simply due to the fact that he did maybe two, I think, works rallies for Subaru. They had a brief flirtation with having a junior team at one point that I think Niall McShay was linked with as well at the time. But Kangas.
Oh, you're right. He was in New Zealand. You know, Finland,
yeah. Bent a car badly.
You know your man in Japan that drives around in the two-door World Rally car?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Junior Matsushita, yes.
I knew you'd know him, Austin. Yeah. That guy, that car that he has,
is the one that Kangas crashed in New Zealand in 98, I think, or something.
Yeah. It's R30, isn't it? R30WRC. Yeah.
Morris is about to rattle off the chassis number there now.
I won't. No. I'm not going. We won't get into
it. Oh, no, actually, I could be wrong. It was either that or that car became the Possum Bourne, which is now the hill climb car, the, like the 800 brake.
No, I think that was a P2000 that ended up.
Somewhere in between those two is the truth, anyway.
Yeah. Look, listeners, go find out for yourself.
Yeah.
We can't hold your hand on everything. Come on.
We mightn't be right, but we're not going to say we're wrong.
No.
Did he?
just going back to Tommy's point on the entry list, I don't know how you finished going through it. I wanted to bring up one thing I spotted there, but I never knew.
Yeah.
Car 157.
Oh, well, this.
Let me scroll down.
There's two things. Go for car 157 and I'll pull a few more.
Yeah, so I had a few notes, but I think this is the most interesting one. Car 157 in an Integra Type R, Michael Murray and Jake Kelly with Irish flags and interest.
And they weren't the only all Irish crew. Car 123 as well, Hugh Dunn and Greg Sinners in the Legacy.
That car had a lot of interest as well. They talked about it, I think, at the time. I remember reading the Irish Motorsport Annual. All the scrutineers were drooling over it because it was an ex-Vatan in Legacy as well. They recognised the edge plate.
I forgot about that. That is class. Yeah. I completely forgot about you.
Michael Murray did a lot of rallies in the mid-90s in like fairly fit Nissans. He had like an F2 Nissan Sunny like in the mid-90s. He was backing from Central Garage,
yeah,
a Nissan Garage, and he had a Group N GTIR before that. And kind of started to slow down or pick and choose his rallies, and obviously decided he'd go after Finland. Hugh Dunn and Greg Shinners at 1, 2, 3. So it was probably the first time in a long time you had two all Irish crews on
what year was it? The lads went over and did Rally Sweden. Did Nesbitt pick the Rally Sweden?
2004.
Nesbitt and George Tracy went 1 year.
2004.
Four, I think.
Greg Shinners, not Greg Shinners, but Rory Galligan went over, I think it was 99.
Did he not go back over in the Group N Evo?
He did. In his last year competition.
Remember there was a very good piece on, I think, was it in Pace Notes, where they talked about the whole adventure that it was to get them over to that event that time.
Mm,
I remember it was a 2 or 3 page kind of segment on it, and it was brilliant.
It was fair going to get him to that event. It was an unbelievable performance by Rory that year when you consider the difficulties he was going through.
Rory was a fantastic talent. It's such a pity that unfortunately he passed. But
and again, you know, I'm one of those guys that just another demonstration of a complete down to earth nice guy in motorsport, because it was around the time when I was starting to spread my wings, kind of thinking I could start rallying when I was 16, 17. When he was running Peugeot Challenge, and I remember I used to be on the phone to him, burning the air off him. But obviously, he wasn't within an ass's roar of actually getting a car to compete. But still, he entertained my conversations and gave me advice and tips. He was an incredibly nice guy.
I bet him.
I think a
few more guys down here, just on the list, as you said, a hugely, competitive era for local guys in pretty top line machinery.
You had the reigning British Rally Champion at Car 45, Marco Apati.
Yeah.
You
Car 137, Rami Raikkonen, Kimi Raikkonen's elder brother.
I was just telling you.
Do you even see Kosti Kachimaki in a Group N polo as well?
Yep.
Yeah, like look down through it, like. Juhas Alo, like boys that go on to win Finnish championships and still rallying now, like they're all, there's just such quality in there. Like Jussi Valimäki was doing the Super 1600s. Like the top five or six in the Super 1600s are all very accomplished drivers now. Cedric Robert, Gian Domenico Basso, Loeb, obviously, Dalla Villa, Manfred Stoll, Nicholas Bernardi, Duval. It's like a who's who.
And Niall McShay.
That's a good point, actually.
And then you've the Irish favourite, Irish fan favourite of Tapio Luukkonen in the Golf GTI.
Tapia was handy, very handy.
I don't know what it is. I'd love to see him.
That was a kick car, wasn't it? It was a Mac 4 kick car, I'm pretty sure. That he was in. But fucking fantastic quality entry. As I said, there's another round of the Super 1600 Championship as well. Different, you know, in fairness, they gave him a good spread of events that year, from tarmac to rough gravel to the likes of Finland and stuff like that. So good to see it. Just moving on to the stages, I suppose. It's some classic finish tests in there. Just looking down through the itinerary, Macapera, Odenpoya, obviously one of the all-time classic finished stages, Lankama, probably pronouncing it wrong, Talvioinen, and Ginord, just names that you just recall from hearing in the coverage all the way up along. As I said, pretty dense route there for the first 2 days, 9 stages per day. Which was in a kind of a shorter day on Sunday in terms of stages. They still had just short of 100 kilometres, but Saturday was the big one, 180 kilometres.
A kind of a notable thing about it, and it's not something you typically associate with the Finnish stages, is the mileage of those classic ones. So if you take Lakama, Loitsu, Unapoya, and Moxie, Loitsu, or however you pronounce it, we're talking 25 up to 40 kilometres of stages. Like, Moxie Loitsu was 41 kilometers alone.
Yeah,
that's a hell of a stage at that speed.
Yeah, it's the speed is mind blowing. Even back then, like, I know the cars are quick. Obviously, I'd actually love to see a comparison, direct comparison on the same stage with the same driver, same conditions.
I've actually just looked up the times there from Moxie when it ran. So it was the first stage on Sunday morning. The average, Burns was fastest, and his average speed was 117 kilometers an hour. Over 40k.
It's some going. Like, you're basically at more or less at the motorway limit there in Ireland for that length of time, but you have to include junctions in that and crests and twos and threes and stuff like that.
And not factoring in slowing down by exit ramps.
Yeah.
You'd love to see it.
A couple of other interesting things. As I said, there was 18 works entries, 3 cars per team. Kankinen was back for Hyundai. They'd done some sort of a deal. Kankinen was so popular in Finland, and still is to this day, great guy. He actually has a street named after him. And there's a funny story. I don't know, is it around his locality, or was it just a fan that used to do it for him? Apparently, there was, on one stage, there was a corner, a quick corner, could have been a fifth gear corner or whatever, with something like a post box or some sort of ornament on, would say, a foot or two inside the road. So what used to happen was the spectator used to move the box for Kankinen, and Kankinen was able to cut it, and the box would reappear for the next car. So just an interesting story, but he was falling over there, and he was one of 4 drivers that had 23 wins apiece going into this event. So, you know,
isn't there another story about Kankinen as well, Morris, about, I think it's about the Unemployer stage. I don't know, was it in McRae's book or Burns book or where we saw or heard it, about how he was in his youth, when he used to be travelling to visit his missus at the time, I don't know if it's still the same one or not, that he used to be over and back that stage, and he'd be driving back from her house at night over on a boy.
No way.
Did anyone ever hear that?
I didn't hear that.
I remember reading that somewhere,
Did he say it himself, where he's like, yeah, I'd be travelling to visit my girlfriend and travel over on a boy and then back that night. Could you imagine what it was like being in the car with him coming back over on a boy at night?
Listening
to ZZ Top
in the Morris Marina or something.
Yeah, or the Avenger or something like that.
And the mustache at 17 years of age, most likely.
Stage one of the 2015 Circuit of Munster, the first kind of major corner on that rally. I used to come back that road from a previous girlfriend's house. Late at night, that kind of crack, just pushing hard, and actually went off in it. And as we were passing it, I actually had it in the notes for the laugh, just watching for that call. But we've all done it. But anyway, just getting into the event. So as I said, 23 wins apiece for Mäkinen, McRae, Sainz and Kankinen. Obviously, Kankinen probably was the one you'd probably least favour just in terms of his machinery for the event. But there was a huge buzz leading up to it. As I said, Mäkinen, the definite favourite, went out like an absolute lunatic off the start line on stage one. There's an in-car of him on that stage. I think if you search on YouTube, you'll find it. I think obviously doesn't quite get to the end, as you'll see. Just such a silly off. It wasn't even an off. He just cut a corner slightly too tight. There was a tree stump in there that they hadn't done the notes and just pulled the upright out of the front left. That was it. Rally over. Like I'd say, they hadn't even really got going. No, he was pushing fair hard, and that's it. If you look at the onboard, he was obviously trying to be quick as over the blocks and kind of give everyone a bit of a scare. But man, what a stupid thing to do! And this
it's
was
dangerous.
This is it.
Wasn't he at least like even with George Donaldson talking about it? At least he was kind of very quick and man enough to go. There's no ridiculous driver's excuse here. I made a mistake. I missed it in the notes and I cut it.
Yeah. No, he was very, that's the way Mäkinen was kind of was very forthright with and honest with what had happened. But like you felt sorry for the guy, like, you know, it was just one of those things.
Mad agitated.
Yeah. But this was actually it. Basically, Mäkinen season pretty much finished here. If you look at it, as we'll see in subsequent events, he only scored one more point between here and the end of the year.
It was mad. There was maybe two or three other things that kind of played into the Mäkinen downfall, because he still kind of would have gone, yeah, and we'll talk about it later, but they had just tested and publicly displayed between the Safari and Finland the Evo World Rally car, which was going to be coming in before the end of the year. So they were going to have to change car before the end of the year. After this rally, George Donaldson leaves Mitsubishi and goes to Subaru. And there was another article, I was just looking back through Ash.net at press releases from the time, and there was rumours after the Safari that Marlboro were looking at maybe moving their sponsorship money elsewhere. And as it happens, they held on for a year, but then they moved off to Peugeot in 2003 when things didn't unfold as they thought.
Yeah.
So it was not only was it the start of Mäkinen's downfall, it was the start of Mitsubishi's downfall in general.
That's amazing. I didn't know that Donaldson actually left
halfway through the season. Donaldson left straight after this rally to start immediately with Subaru in a newly created role, which was, I want to find it here, the Subaru World Rally Team has announced the arrival of George Donaldson as sporting director.
Yeah. I was just going to say, definitely the sporting director.
In a newly created role, he'll oversee the sporting and non-technical aspects of the team.
That's amazing.
But he left Mitsubishi in the middle of the season.
That's really, as you said, this was almost the start, definitely symbolic for the beginning of the end of Mitsubishi as a force in World Rally, wasn't it? That tree stump and Parkala or whatever the stage was. It was the end of Mac. It was the start of the downturn of Mackinnon's career as well, really, wasn't it? They were kind of got up to the same heights again, unfortunately. That's some pretty amazing stuff. We'll link on those articles. Actually, some of the old Crash.net articles are very interesting to look back on. From the time, McRae passed him. He was second on the road and got to the just age. Turned to Griston, just in the typical kind of understated McRae fashion. Just goes. Not a good start for Tommy, you know, which was putting it lightly, I suppose. But so as expected, Granholm and Rovan Pera were absolutely flying. The 206 just all through this event just sounded so sharp. Man, I don't know, had a different map on or something. It sounded like it had about 50 more horsepower than anything else out there.
They had a TTE turbo.
Yeah, but even there's a couple of videos of it on start lines and stuff like that. Oh man, just a class machine.
Super machine.
Burns as well. Burns was flying. Burns had put in a great showing in 2000 up until his big off. and definitely had rally winning pace at this stage in Finland. So it was interesting to see how he was getting on.
And bear in mind, he was now 9 months without a win.
Yeah, and he had a great run there in 99 as well. He ran Kankinen really close in 99.
Yeah.
So he had had a couple of years under his belt there.
Yeah, definitely. He was at the pace. And like a really, really hard thing to do, to go to Finland to compete with guys who've literally grown up on these roads and take it to them. Like it just shows how much of a talent Burns was, and how good his notes were and stuff like that. Because, you know, like any rally, you have to trust the notes. But I think in Finland especially, you have to, it's the difference between backing off or leaving the throttle pedal off half a mil or whatever, having that trust to keep it pushed into the bulkhead.
It probably doesn't make any difference. And you were kind of talking about it a bit last week, actually, about notes and stuff like that. And would seem from an outsider looking in, or as someone who doesn't use descriptive notes, that it is the kind of event, because the landscape and the roads have so many different characteristics to them, that having more descriptive notes would definitely be a help with the road. It would certainly seem that way. The very three-dimensional roads is how you describe it.
I think, given the kind of the nature and the characteristics of the roads, with corners over long blind crests and stuff, having that extra element rather than just relying on it, because the, like in other types of roads, having the gear system, fair enough, might suit. But they even actually did a piece in this event on the recce with Burns and Reed. There's actually a point I was going to make there about the talk through the, and again, you'll see this in probably every season, every time they do these features, they'll do the recce feature, given the casual fan behind the scenes of what actually happens. And like, because the one thing stuck out to me there is, one, obviously hearing Reed's process of getting the descriptive notes out in recce, and then two, one of my favourite things is those ProDrive white recce cars.
Oh yeah, the classic.
It's still an absolute dream of mine is to build a replica roll going just white and Prezza with gold, gravel gold OZs or Speedlands, or OZs, and then the silver tint on the window.
And a big roof vent.
Big roof vent. And I don't care how stupid I'd look, I'd have my ProDrive recce car.
No, they're a cool bus.
All diff guards, tank guards and everything.
Absolutely. Oh, but yeah, they were just a great performance out of him. And just worth mentioning as well, Marco Martin was absolutely flying. I think he actually set a quick assignment day one. So yeah, and obviously
he hadn't been nominated for points. Subaru nominated Solberg and Burns. I suppose you could flip a coin maybe at this stage between Solberg and Martin, but Martin had just won a rally in Estonia as a warm up to this.
The EOS rally was
a bit of a marker in the team.
As we know, the roads in Estonia are quite similar to what you have here. Same sort of just mad quick stages, lots of blind crests and big commitment needed. So definitely a promising sign for Martin. He always went well in Finland.
And again, the unique thing about Martin as well is, you know, it's something they spoke about a lot, is he's largely self-taught. I know it sounds strange in a running context, but you have a lot of drivers who they'll have the natural flair, but they'll go through the process of learning driving styles from experienced pilots and that kind of thing. But Marco Martin didn't really have a lot of access to that stuff, being based out of Estonia. I know there was a big focus on the fact that he, very different style, very different approach, but it's something that worked.
Yeah, he was the first.
Do you mean like a lack of tutors?
I think I remember seeing or reading or seeing it before. Again, just come back from my mental archives, are probably unreliable, but they talk about Marco Martin being very kind of a very different approach to driving, very kind of self-generated, no real kind of, he didn't really follow the typical mold of developing drivers at the world level.
He was the first Estonian to make it to the very top, wasn't he? And obviously the current world champion is an Estonian, so
Martin had a very large hand in his career as well.
He does, yeah. Does a huge relationship there between the two. But fair play to him. He was going really well. He also had the support of the MMSC, which is the Marco Martin Friends Club.
So that sounds really nice, doesn't it?
It's just friends, it's a really happy,
it's
happy.
It's, it's, it's not like a fan club.
It's not like the football hooligan element you get with some clubs or whatever. Like, this is just a load of lads having a crack.
So someone's going to form a breakaway faction, the Marco Martin Casuals.
Yeah.
Or you have like a different group. You have like the Marco Martin fan club. You have the Solberg Ultras.
Yeah.
All these firms meeting up in a forest in Radnor.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Dovin be all elite.
Yeah.
With Frodo leading them through an underground bridgeway.
Kicking
slags.
Yeah. But so that was kind of the main, I suppose, aspects of day one. As I said, Burns leading. There was a bit of controversy at the end. Granholm, no, he said he had a puncher. But he definitely was dropping a bit of time. His time dropped away off on the last stage, and it's kind of debatable to you know, what was he trying to just slip behind Burns? It was the kind of event you wouldn't have needed to be sixth or seventh in the road. Just one car behind might have been sufficient just to get an advantage or whatever, but
sorry, do you want to finish there?
It kind of played into Burns' confidence as well. You know, he made a comment that it's good to know that on his home rally he has to do that to try and beat me. You know, he kind of saw it as a bit of a confidence boost for himself there.
McRae was kind of playing it safe, I think, really on day one. He was, I wouldn't say holding back, but not quite kind of taking the risks that he needed to take, really, you know, because it seemed to be the race was between Burns, Granholm, and
I wonder if Ravenpera broke a shock on stage seven and he dropped from, I think, second down to fifth by the end of the day. I wonder if he hadn't dropped back to fifth and it was still Peugeot 1-2 up the front, would Granholm have had the worries about maybe dropping back? You know, Peugeot would have knocked out the front there, but like he only dropped back, I think, 3 seconds behind Burns, so he was playing it fairly fine.
Yeah, because I was wondering about this, like, especially with the amount of effort the teams put into their weather teams and stuff, like whether or not the weather on day two was unpredicted in terms of the mist and dewy coming down. So you have the reverse effect of typical road position where you have the nice soft compact gravel surface. Fair enough, if it's dry, you may want to drop a couple of seconds into second. But no, having the knowledge about the weather coming on day two, you absolutely want to be first in the road.
They might not have had it because I don't think it was expected. No, it wasn't rain. It was just a little bit of dew.
It was misty, but the road was damp. So like it cuts up quite quickly. And again, going back to the point about the finished stages, where in some sections it gets quite rutted and rough. And you add in wet gravel on top of that and it can get quite shitty.
Yeah. Burns had, unfortunately, on the first stage in day two, apparently he was up on the splits, but he got to the end of the stage and the tire was gone. The moose obviously didn't inflate or whatever. He didn't drop a huge amount of time, but 15 seconds or so, but obviously it was enough to put him down. Finland is one of those rallies where, you know, a minute gap is pretty much insurmountable, you know, because the pace is so hot.
On the moose, I know Michelin had that ATS or whatever it was called. Did Pirelli have a similar version or an equivalent?
They would have had to have. Jesus, there's no way Pirelli weren't running moose at this stage as well, was there?
Yeah, sure. I wonder. It's only the Michelin one I ever seem to remember. But Pirelli must have had, because it just looked like it was, as hard as it is to believe on the first stage of the day, like excessive wear or something.
It was a strange one. There was no clip on the onboard of him hitting it or anything like that. Maybe they didn't get it, but look, it was just one of those things. Anyway, it dropped him out. But he was, you know, he was the show between here and the end of the event. He definitely had the pace to win if things had fallen a little bit better for him. Ariel went out, unfortunately. He was actually not going to bed. He wasn't quite at the level of the local boys, but he was still thereabouts. The issue with his suspension and just breaking for a junction, and the car just took off and that put him out.
Rovan Pera got the better of him before that, though. He was lying fourth, I think, and Rovan Pera was chasing him down anyway.
Yeah, Rovan Pera was one of the stars of the season, really, wasn't he? He was one of the big finds for Peugeot, even though he'd been around for a couple of years at this stage. Every rally he did, he seemed to be doing the right things. You know, he put in a great performance from.
It was almost like a less successful version of Granholm's season the year before. You know, both won in Sweden and both weren't expected to be the team leader or the leading team driver at the halfway point of the season. And you get to the stage at the end of this leg, the second leg, where Corrado Provera has to decide, well, do I tell them to hold station or let them go for it? Like, so it was a real statement of the level of Rovan Pera that he got to, that he was able to.
But on that, I found it quite strange that it was at that point of the rally that they were calling team orders, was halfway through day two. I don't know, it just seemed a bit...
I think it was at the end. Was it the end of the day? I think going into the day three, I think they made the definite decision.
I think it was the end of the day, but you had a massive day three left. But as it happened, you know, team orders wouldn't have really mattered in the end up.
Yeah.
They did, like, realistically, you know, you have a couple of specialist tarmac rallies coming in the latter half of the year. Rovan Pera would have had to win here and do very well everywhere else. Discounted those tarmac rallies, which Panizzi would have been cleaning up on anyway.
Yeah.
Wouldn't have even been nominating them for manufacturer's points. And Rivera did say in the coverage that they were only targeting, and it was maybe a sign of how bad their season had gone, that they were only targeting the manufacturers now. And that they were going to mix and match it as best they could. And that, but if a driver is doing well, fine. You know, he said he'd give Harry a car for the two tarmac rallies, but like, what's going to do a whole lot, you know?
It's a talk and gesture, really.
If Harry had won Finland, and do you know what was it? Was it Portugal he retired from? Do you know he actually, looking at the points at the end of the year, and even looking at Granholm's points at the end of the year, because everyone else basically self-destructed towards the second half of the season.
Yeah,
they shot
up. Well, heading into this event, like, it was Mäkinen on 40, McCray on 30, Sainz on 26. Rovan Pera on 20 and Burns on 15. That was your top five in the championship. Yeah. Granholm only had 4 points heading into this event.
Yeah,
a shocking season.
Yeah, but he had a fantastic turnaround. He could have been closer to the top had things fallen his way and a couple of the later events as we'll see. But yeah. just an interesting one. One point I've always wanted to know this, and I've never actually got a proper answer for it. One of you might know. Why do the Finnish drivers run the cars with Finnish plates? Like, the Peugeots and every other rally were on...
It's a road traffic... Now, I know all the other teams didn't do it. And I don't know why...
Is there something to do with the fact that the Finnish drivers have Finnish driving licenses on them as well as the competition license?
Yeah, you could be onto something there. Although, what did Passanen have on his focus?
I'm pretty sure all the Finnish lads had local Finnish plates, and it might be tied, as you said, back into the license or something. Especially
because it's something I'm pretty sure this is true around in terms of the speeding fines in Finland. So if you get stopped, because something I've been told from people who've been at the event that if you get stopped speeding in Finland, your fine is proportional to your income.
Yeah.
So, that's why I was making a joke about if you get stopped speeding in Finland, you tell them you're unemployed because
it's a good point actually. Yeah, better watch out for that.
Big money. You know, so maybe it's something to do with that if they're getting stopped, that it's because of the Finnish license, they have to tie it back to a Finnish reg. You know, I don't know.
The cars this year anyway all seem to be, there might have been a different style of plate, but they seem to be running their works regs. The Peugeot seem to be French. And the Fords and Subarus and
Kankinen's car and Gardemeister's car are running their official ridges anyway.
Yeah.
But it is something that happens. I don't know if it's a road traffic thing or not, because another thing that happens now in Finland in recent years, the driver's number plate, and I think in Sweden as well, is also up on the windscreen in case your bumper comes off. or they have it on the bodywork behind the bumper in case the bumper comes off.
Let's say, or like the sticker Monte Carlo when they're running studs. It's Sweden as well,
Yeah. Robin Pera was going through rear bumpers at an awful rate as well.
He was hammering through them.
As usual, yes. It's kind of his trademark, really, was to see a 206 with half the sharp enough car as it was. But he was making him even sharper. If he'd been in an Octavia, he would have left half it behind in the tree. But
you know, I often wondered at what point, do you know when they do the like a random weighing of the cars mid-event, is that post-service when they've been repaired all bodywork or what's the story?
Jeez, did you imagine if a bumper now was to put them down, yeah, to put them under, wouldn't it?
If they can pull lads over the weight of the thickness of your windows, I think they could pull them over the weight of a bumper.
Yeah, it's a good point.
I'm just curious as to what point it happens. I'm assuming it's after service from the cars or somewhere. Yeah. Right.
I don't know that now.
They would build a certain amount of weight into a car that if you lost a bumper, like if you were without a wheel and a jack, your car might be underweight, but a bumper.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Likely enough. And the window thing is, I remember all the Fords got pegged out one year for that.
Right, yeah.
But that was your windows were meant to be of a certain thickness. It actually had nothing to do with the weight, and it was just a washer was the wrong size. You know, it was just technicality in the paperwork.
But mad stuff, yeah, like, isn't it, when you get into that level.
You'd be cutting it tight enough, I suppose. Now, maybe not so much with the 01 cars, but certainly when the Safari didn't feature anymore and things got a bit more mental from 03, 04 on.
They were definitely running down to their limit.
Christian Lario not letting the lads take, you know, two pencils with them, only one, and that kind of stuff.
Jesus Christ.
I'm fairly sure that's true.
Having light milk in their cereal in the morning.
Yeah.
No one wants that UHC stuff because it's shite.
Shite, yeah.
No demand for it.
So look, at the end of the day too, Granholm from Robin Pera, obviously Peugeot had made the decision then overnight to get the boys to hold station. Bit of a pity. You'd like to have seen the two lads go at it, but that's the way it was. They, as you said, they had their main priority was the manufacturer's point, so they didn't want to jeopardize that. Burns in third, good drive. McRae was up to fourth. McRae never actually went all that well in Finland when you think about it. He never demonstrated rally winning pace, or you know, the kind of potential to
the year before he was second.
Yeah,
he's a good run.
He was having some fastest times here as well, but nothing McRae level spectacular. But I think, I don't know, like, was it just the nature of the roads that he just
he mentioned a couple of times on the coverage, and it was alluded to with Sainz as well, that they didn't feel that the focus had the grunt on such a flat out event to win on speed alone. And certainly when you look at, as Maris
said,
the likes of the Peugeot really did seem to be turned up and more torquey and more of a go.
He never really had a clean run at the rally. Like, in if you look at, say, 1996, his recce was interrupted because he had to go to an FIA hearing to do with, I think, a spectator got clipped in
Argentina,
in a service area, and I think he binned it in a big way. I think shortly after that, himself and Derek Ringer were sent in separate directions, and it was, you know, 98 he went off. The margins are so fine there, but to be in the right car at the right time also is an important thing there too. I don't think it's any slight on McRae. Like, I was just watching Jani Pastinen in this rally, and he went very well early on, but equally he had a rally reminiscent of McRae in the Legacy in 92. You know, the car was barely recognisable as a Focus by the time he was done, in much the same way that the Legacy was destroyed bit by bit. So you can kind of see why McRae probably playing the long game here. You know, he knew the limitations of the car and knew the limitations of how quick the Finns were going to be there as well.
He also knew Mäkinen was out, and he was ahead of Sainz, who was the only other person behind him, but like immediately close behind him in the championship.
Yeah. So, which, do you know what? It kind of brings back to the point we spoke a lot before about that kind of underlying intelligence of McRae's drives. You know, the stuff he never got credit for, like, behind the marketed image of the flat out, if in doubt, flat out.
It's only 4 seconds behind Burns at the end of day two. You know what I mean?
That's like, very close. Like when all the coverage is around the pace and confidence of Burns against the locals, McRae was playing the signs card in this event, quietly finishing with no dramas.
Yeah, and like on the last three stages of the rally, McRae is second fastest on them all. And like by minimal amounts, and obviously he manages to sneak a good points haul out of it, but his final day was actually super.
It was, to be fair.
On day two as well, we never covered Gardemeister's off.
That was day three.
That's the very last stage of the rally.
He nearly clipped a squirrel, but he missed him on day two.
Is that place where Gardemeister went off the same place that Danny Sordo went off?
Yeah,
that's
the spot.
There's a big rock in Onan Pie, and it has both their names on it now. It's a real deceptive spot. The year I went to watch it, we drove some of the stage, and we went to that bit with a view to maybe, oh, we'll watch at it. But we ended up going to the Yellow House jump for two runs. But it's real deceptive, and it's a kind of place where you shouldn't fly too far at all, because if you do fly too far, you're fucked. And that's exactly what happened to him. And I'm not sure how much, again, it exposed maybe some of the failings of Mitsubishi plowing on with the Group A car. You know, you were limited in terms of what you could do with suspension travel and all the rest of it, compared to what you had in the World Rally Car regulations. And there's outside footage of Gardemeister, and the Oak just bunny hops. Now, he does jump way too far, but a bunny hops and the back goes up in the air, and sure, he's never going to catch it and makes a million bits of it.
Does a big off? No, I think there's a combination maybe of the car, but definitely his speed into it was very high, and he was kind of pushing. He'd lost time early in the event. We didn't really mention it, actually. He had brake troubles, like a lot of other drivers came through and actually went out with similar. But he wasn't at the races.
As well.
And Likes was miles behind as well. And just what you mentioned there about Mitsubishi earlier on, that's very, very interesting. I'm still a bit more looking into that. Sad in a way, again, you know, the beginning of the end of one of the all-time great teams in the sport. But just that's just the way things go. Yeah. Just before we go into the finish of the event, I'd like to just give a shout out to Finnish dance music of this era as well. This is the era of Darude and Sandstorm. Can you feel the beat? Yeah. So fair play to him. I think it was big over there at the time. You'd see some footage there.
Were the bomb funk MCs, were they from Finland as well?
I think so, yeah.
I don't.
Maybe they were. We'll have to look into that, actually. I actually have a slightly related question for you, since you're all kind of into electronica and stuff as well. Who of the...
Bomb funk MCs, Finnish hip-hop group, yes.
There you go.
All right.
That's the job. Who of the 2001 WRC field do you think would be most likely to branch out and start their own experimental ambient techno side project?
Who would you go for? Who's like real kind of Robotronic?
Does it have to be the top full-time drivers, or
if you want to go delving into the injury list, you can do it too, but don't expect us to know who it is. Like,
I'd say Timo Rautiainen, a Navigator, actually. I'd like to see him.
That's a great
good shout. He's got a very craftworky kind of vibe about him, isn't he?
I ran with the Pretty Wild Crew, yeah. What's that part? Remember that I think it's always Sunny in Philadelphia.
I could go for a bit of that, all right.
Yeah. Tommy, what's your thoughts, Tommy?
You just see Velimaki, I don't know.
Have you just given up?
Yeah.
Is it past your bedtime? Okay, sorry, we'll wrap this
up. No, you're grand.
Okay.
You had my vote.
Okay. I was gonna say
Matt. I was wrong as well.
Francois Duval could be another man for that too.
He'd be too lazy.
In Tallinn, there's actually a Depeche Mode tribute bear, or it's a themed bear. So Marco Martin.
Yeah, I was going to say Marco Martin. It's kind of got a kind of a post-Soviet sort of a kind of a vibe going on.
Good
there.
Shout.
Yeah,
good shout.
Berlin-y sort of a thing. But anyway, yeah. So just on the end of the event, okay, we'd like to give a shout out to Robin Pera's entry into Junction on the second last stage is the best thing I've ever seen. He basically took three lefts to make a right, but he got around it in one move, fastest. So some going, but it was probably caused by he had an issue with his shock. One of the shocks was failing at that point, and he was actually handicapped in the last stage, and he would be, but he lost a lot of time, ended up dropping down the leaderboard. So a bit of a pity. Could have been a nice little finish to the rally for Peugeot with the 1-2, but unfortunately he didn't get it. And then I suppose that was Granholm cruising to a pretty controlling win there. Seemed to be well within himself, as he always did in Finland. No major stress, just drove the car around. Even like if you look at him on the jumps and stuff like that, it was just his way. He was never the guy to fly the longest or the highest or whatever. It was all very controlled. It seemed like he had another 5% in him, whereas everyone else was pushing like mad to try and catch him. So he's definitely my driver of the rally, I think, anyway.
I went down a bit of a wormhole in after that, watching that, just watching some of his in-cars. He was such a deceptively quick driver. I have a bit of a thread going on Twitter. I actually haven't updated in the last few days. Just kind of like a thread of really good in-cars from back over the years and even various different disciplines. There's one of him in Australia in a few years' time. It's a wet, foggy, misty stage, but the speed he carries is unbelievable. But on a rally like this, it's all about speed. And I think there's even a couple of quotes maybe at the time from Granholm. He's like, if you're up in the air, you're not carrying a whole lot of speed. You're going to lose it when you come back down again. And he just played it perfectly. Like, what did he win by? 25 seconds, and it was comfortable in the end.
Yeah, I think even with Robin Pera dropping back, like he had a comfortable lead. But that thing with Robin Pera in the last stage, or was the last stage or the second last? Like that was massively important for Burns points wise.
Huge.
Looking at if you look at, he has obviously the kind of the top four finishers, like with the championship points at the end of it. Like Burns was still sitting down in fifth in the championship after this event, even with that game points. Robin Pera was still ahead of him.
Yeah, I think Robin Pera's drive was quite impressive to still be able to go down a top four place driving an Empire with a shock that, well, with three shocks on the car. One of the stages that you really, of all of them, you'd like to have everything working right in there. So I think that's fantastic performance.
And he broke a shock on day one as well.
Yeah, like you have to give him some bit of credit on that. Like, you know, brilliant performance from all the top three, but you, a notable mention really for Owen Pera.
I think
if I was to pick somebody, and I'm going to be really awkward on this one, it's a drive that kind of, it's not in any of the World Rally cars. Tapio Laukkanen finished 23rd. Doesn't sound very remarkable, but like we said, he was in an F2 car. He was just behind the World Rally cars and ahead of every other four-wheel drive car.
Well, yeah, I think on the driver of the event, Tommy, I was going to agree with you on Robin Pera, but I think I might go a bit left field like you did there. I think for me, let's go down to the 1600 category and go to a young fella by the name of Lowe, who won the class by 5.5 minutes with a minute penalty for checking in early.
Yeah, unreal.
He really wiped the floor with him, didn't he?
Like he's never actually won Finland in a World Cup, has he?
Yes, he has.
Sorry. But if you look at that, like a French driver in a French pocket rocket that probably isn't the most suited to that type of event, winning by 5.5 minutes with a minute penalty.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say it was probably his first time in Finland.
It probably was. Then, for me, that's the drive of the event. It really showed what was about to come.
There was
he did Finland the previous year in a BTS Saxo, but that was it.
Yeah.
Like, that's unreal.
That's some going, and I suppose a kind of an ominous sign. I don't think, you know, it was no disgrace if you were in the Super 1600 Championship that year to be beaten by Loeb, because is probably one of the best the sport has ever seen or ever will see. So, you know, to be even near competitive with him is a fair achievement. But there was actually, on the first day, one of the puntos had a huge crash on the Macapera jumps. And it was something that kind of surprised me, was how close the spectators were, you know, and lining the road all the way. There was a sequence there of five or six jumps in a row. And, like, there's no real safeness to stand there if you think about it. But the whatever it is, there never seems to be major, you know.
There was a fatality in 96, though.
A fella on the tarmac stage
went straight up like an escape road with loads of people, like his brakes failed or something.
I do think the spectating can be quite sketchy still in Finland, because you'd see what the guys
100%.
The Dutch guys, rallymedia.nl, their videos, you'd see. I remember something that really sticks out to me was the year Chris Meek and Paul Nagel won the rally, and was the outside of a corner, and there was a lady who was quite clearly pregnant, a fella beside her, on the outside of a corner. It was fourth or fifth gear, and it was a tighter corner than that, but they were clearly taking it in fourth or fifth gear. But these are the things that you don't see anymore in the TV production that goes aired out to, you know, BT Sport or on the WRC Plus app. They won't show the stuff that really doesn't show it in the best light either, you know, because they can't be seen to either, you know. That'd be my view on it too, you know.
Yeah, but the speeds are that mental in Finland, and the roads are that undulating, and you can commit to them so much that you could, regardless of how good you are, you could have a massive crash on any corner. And that's if you're a skilled driver. Like, and this was one of the last rallies. It was in one of the pre-event releases. They were saying it was 160 started. They were saying it was the final time so many cars would be able to start a world championship rally because of impending limits on entry numbers. And I presume that was to do with, you know, TV coverage and getting stuff packaged and out on time and centralized service areas and all the rest. Like, they even moved the service area on Saturday and Sunday out to an airfield halfway between Jyväskylä and Tampere, whereas nowadays service is completely centralized in the middle of Jyväskylä in a big conference center. So all of that stuff, I suppose, necessitates the rally changing, but it's such the most mental part of if anyone ever goes to Rally Finland, the best thing you can do is on the Saturday, find out what stages the Vetimese rally is running on, which is like the national guys. And they run somewhere, they don't run every stage, they might run half the stages. It's a bit like the national rally on GB. They kind of run a funny kind of schedule. But they ran Onan Pia. So full field ran Onan Pia, and then the Vetimese rally went through, and then the second run of the World Cars came back. But the first couple of eyes in that are just outstanding to watch. You have like the big E36 N3s, which seem to be like Mark II Escorts over there, but super fit. The EP3 Civics, that's the only type of Civic they seem to rally over there, with mental fit engines. And apparently they're the worst of the Civics here, but they seem to make them work in Finland.
Yeah.
Starlets, and they have some fella in like a step two Lancer WRC, just complete random go. It's just mental. The variation of stuff.
They don't get to do
a recce.
Isn't it? Do you remember the show? Was it called? Was it on?
Tim Motors.
Do you remember? Was it called the Rally Review Show with David Winstanley? And they used to have the footage of national events in Finland. Same of lads and Saabs and Volvos. Absolutely on the limit.
Motors,
loading cars off the outside of the stage and back on and finishing.
Motors TV had the F Cup for a while. I remember, I think, to be honest with you, if you film something yourself with a camcorder, there was a period where Motors TV was dangerous.
They take you on.
They take it on, like, you know. But what I always admire about the Finns is that the car is in the middle of going off in the accident, the lads are already running. you know, the car hasn't even stopped moving and they're all
there's a brilliant one from is it 2 years ago? Someone is spectating in Finland, Rally Finland, and whatever corner it is, it's notorious enough corner, but he has a GoPro on his head, and he's on the inside of the corner, and every time a car goes off, he's running to push it out. But there's a gang of about 10 of them, like, they know as soon as the fella's coming over the crest, he's not making it, and they're at it. I must find it and throw it up. But it's he's the big, like, pair of, like, builder's gloves on him and everything. Like, he's properly ready for action.
Bit of a shout-out as well, actually, to Trevor Agnew and Neil Weirden. They had a good run. They finished 17th, and they were flanked either side by Marco Allen and Bruno Thierry. So I suppose for guys that were, they were quick, they were proven to be very quick in the BRC and had done previous rounds, but to go to Finland and get a result inside the top 20 like that, around people that are experienced, regulars in Finland, that was a good finish.
Be cool to be at the start of a stage with Marco Allen as well and Bruno Thierry, wouldn't it?
Marco Allen was third quickest on one of the stages. It was a super special, but he was still third quickest.
Jesus, Marco.
In a 99 car, he was in an older spec car as well. Like,
he was an older car, Marco, yeah, what a hero. He was the most Italian of Finns, as they used to describe him back in the day. But an absolute legend. Anyone who's familiar with some of the Group E footage, he's synonymous with Lancia for a long time. I think even when he switched to other teams, whenever he left Lancia, he'd often end up pulling into the Lancia service area only to be met with fellas he used to drive with before and be told to go to the Toyota service area down the road or whatever. But a legend.
What happened to his son and to Alain? Remember, he was doing the IRC for a few years in the Punto S 2000.
Anton Alain,
disappeared. Yeah, just disappeared. I think
kind of when Fias kind of pulled the pin on it, that was really it, because I think that was around the time the IRC was kind of coming into its stride, but Fiat seemed to be pulling their backing as that was coming into its stride, and the WRC wasn't in the best of health, so I just think it petered out a bit, because I think he finished 10th in Finland 1 year I don't know why I'm thinking he finished 10th. He definitely finished in the top 10 of one of the WRC events.
That's a good point. Maybe Fiat kind of realised that they just got out of dodge while the going was good for them before the likes of Peugeot and Skoda started dominating in the IRC. But it's just an interesting one. There's been a couple of kind of Finnish sons that have gone on to have reasonably good careers themselves. I know Granholm's son now is getting into the rallycross side of things as well. So just an interesting thing there. It spotted at the very end of the event when Granholm got out of the car in the service area. He was greeted by, I know it's his engineer, one of the Peugeot management, and he just said simply, "You are back." And that was looking at it and what was to happen over the next 18 months. And especially with the way Mäkinen went out at the start of the event, it was almost like the event where the baton was passed from Mäkinen to Granholm as the number one Finnish driver. Obviously, we didn't know it at the time, but Granholm was to go on to have just an amazing run over the next 18 months or so. Obviously, he went on to dominate in 2002, but it was just.
Can we make a point of something I actually never mentioned? Granholm's 2020, I'm calling it a COVID haircut, where he looks like a young Kevin Bacon. can we make that the sponsor of this event instead of Kayla?
Whoever cut it for him.
Yeah, Granholm's haircut that made him look like Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
This is Kevin Bacon, as in Kevin Bacon from which era Kevin Bacon are we talking here?
A young pre-footballer Kevin Bacon.
Oh, well, that's all right.
Granholm. Yeah.
I was watching the coverage and I thought, Jesus, he looks like someone else.
Was the two Irish crews finished as well, actually.
Fair play to them. That's
Hugh Dunn was finished 51st overall and 73rd overall.
Very good. So. Very good. Wasn't it amazing how Granholm was able to just fold himself into the 206 as well? Because that's the only way you could describe it. He used to have to fold himself in. It was a small car, like, and he was a big man. He was
like a spider tucking into the corner of
him
sitting.
I always thought that was funny. Like the next year when Burns went to Peugeot, Burns was a tall man too. I would have had, I don't know now, we'll have to go doing weird kind of Googling to find out how tall they were. But I would have presumed Granholm was taller than Burns. And yet one of the big problems about Burns going to Peugeot was they were concerned he wouldn't fit in the car. So Granholm was already in it.
But I think, no, the big problem with Burns, the difference is, and I know Burns makes this point in his book as well, I know I keep referring back to it, but I don't care. He used to have his legs a lot more straight than a lot of drivers.
Right.
So Burns' seat and position would be a lot further back than what is normal for WRC cars, even though they're all quite far back. But yeah. Have you ever seen, he always sits a lot lower and a lot more straight-legged with the steering wheel quite close to him.
That was it. I think they found it difficult to get the seat back far enough, as you said.
Yeah.
To get uncomfortable, but Granholm just kind of
your helmet would be too close to the main hoop of the roll cage then, I suppose. No?
Oh, yeah. I know that feeling.
Yeah. Granholm just
see, kind of Granholm's cousin got in an eighth there as well, Sebastian Lindholm.
Yeah.
Oh, the man who rolled it off in 04.
The trail
side. Yeah, while leading.
That's right. Yeah. Was a real sweet crash.
A family affair for Granholm, because Timo Rautiainen and his co-driver, and as we've just kind of decided amongst ourselves, Finland's most promising up and coming ambient techno producer is his brother-in-law as well. So, you know, there's a nice little event for them to finish up with that.
Actually, do we talk at all about Henning Solberg? He was entered in a pro at WRC.
He was, yeah.
Did he finish, Tommy?
Fat Petter.
Fat Petter, Jesus.
I don't think
he's also had a great time for Henning Solberg. Is a proper good character.
Yeah, he's
that's just, you'd love to go for pints with him in Elena.
Oh, 100%. Imagine going for pints down on West Cork, down at one of the pubs on the ring stage with Henning Solberg, Daniel Elena, and Kimi Räikkönen.
I thought you were going to say Daniel Carlson.
No, I have Kimi Räikkönen there just for drama.
He'll drive us home. Oh wait.
Yeah, well, that's Kimi Räikkönen, drink the place dry, drive home and be fastest over the stage than everyone.
Yeah.
He didn't finish it, just to burst your bubble.
Like, so at the end of all of that, Mäkinen was still leading the bloody championship.
Yeah.
He was, yeah.
Now, not for much longer. Mäkinen on 40, McRae second on 34, Sainz, who had a so-so Finland, but got a pint, got him up to 27 points. Ravenpera, 23 points. Burns didn't move up the championship, but he got 6 points, up to 21. And Granholm shot up to 6th in the championship on 14 points.
Yeah.
And Ford tied with Mitsubishi, the manufacturers, at the 66 points each after the end of this. Yeah.
And Peugeot were just kind of getting back going again. They were in third, but they were to have a very decent finish to the season. It's just interesting to note as well, you know, we spoke a lot in the last few events and about the unreliability of the 206. The pace was always there, obviously. Just, it would have been interesting to see how the season would have panned out had they been able to stay going on some of the rougher events. You know, they obviously got things sorted for 2002. And then for some reason just kind of collapsed again in 03. But anyway, you know, when Peugeot, like we said before, when the PSA group want to do something right, they tend to do it in a fashion that just makes everyone else look like they're standing still. Like, it was the same with the 205 T16 back in the Group B days. They did it at Le Mans with the 905. They did it again with the 908 and stuff. You know, when they put their mindset, they're unreal. And obviously Citroën in as well. With the Zara and the C4 and the DS3 and stuff like that, just some brilliant minds over there. But yeah, so that was Rally Finland, another very, very interesting event in a very interesting year. So as we see, the championship is starting to kind of turn in its head. Again, just one of the many twists and turns during the season. some drivers having some very strong events. Other drivers that you'd imagine would have done well have fallen by the wayside for various reasons. So we're heading to New Zealand next, another classic event, some of the best rally roads in the world, for anyone that's familiar with the event. So, and as you said, hopefully we'll be able to get Trevor Agnew and Neil Wearden on with us to share their experiences of the 2001 season, and more besides, either in that episode or very soon thereafter. So looking forward to that, so keep an ear out for that as well. I'm just going to give a small plug as well, just keep an eye on us on the social media channels. It's just at Sprint Ireland across all the various platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever it is. I'll hold my hand up and say I'm not that active on them, but give us a like and a subscribe to the podcast, all that kind of stuff. If you have any questions or comments for us, be sure and leave them. So yeah, anything else you want to add, lads, before we wind things up?
No, nothing from him. Happy with all our divergences and incorrect facts again.
Incorrect facts.
You're heading into savage events now. Two of them, like two tarmac rallies there, that would favour specialists in terms of points. And for the guys in the championship hunt, you know, Italy and France were almost going to be damage limitation exercises. Like, and that threw, well, as we'll see, it threw into particular people's favour. But this is just at the stage now where the whole thing is starting to come to the boil.
Yeah. So as I said, yeah, that's us for this week. So we'll hopefully keep safe out there. And we'll chat to you soon. So from myself and the lads, good luck.